Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. The way to get us questions is via radioprogram@AOL.com. Just email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll answer as many as possible if they're appropriate and concise. And our Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mutin, is with us. Layla is a registered dietitian. She also has earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. And we work together taking care of patients at the Hoffman Center on a daily basis. So how are you doing?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So
Trying to stay warm.
You know, we had that big snow dump, but the weather's been pretty, you know, look, this would be like freezing for Los Angeles, for West Coast people with thin blood, but or Floridians.
That's true.
But it feels really kind of balmy, you know, compared to what we've had to undergo with a big snowstorm. So anyway, so before we get to questions, I just want to share with listeners who haven't yet seen my article that is talking back to the Frontline special that appeared a couple of weeks ago. Really a hit piece on supplements. Very unfair, very biased. And I've tried to counter it in a couple of ways. One is we did just an outstanding interview that I really would like you to lend us your ears for. Give us a half an hour or 40 minutes and listen to the interview that I did with Dan Fabricant.
Yeah,
Daniel Fabricant of the National Products, the National Natural Products Association, the NPA, because he was interviewed in the Frontline special, and they really drilled into him. And I think the attempt was to make him look bad, to make him look like a mouthpiece for the industry. And also they kind of questioned his past working for the FDA, suggesting there was kind of a revolving door policy. You know, you work for government, then you work for private industry, you work for a lobbying organization. And isn't that the way of the world in Washington? The former regulators end up trying to protect the regulated from regulation. And so he really, I think, articulated very well some objections to the way that NPR handled it. And I don't think I've ever seen anything more heavy-handed, more concertedly biased than that thing from NPR. And we come to think of, well, NPR, a standard of excellence, you know, it's like very, you know, journalistic.
It's like, what's left? Who can we listen to now, right?
Right, exactly. Right. But, you know, I have to say that NPR, in some ways, reflects a government agenda. They are highly funded by the federal government, and it is now apparently the federal government's agenda to clamp down on supplements. And so they're trying to create a drumbeat of concern and suspicion about supplements so that Congress and the regulators can tighten the strictures on supplement manufacture and development and ultimately deprive consumers of the right to free access to supplements that are innovative. So anyways, we batted that around. I want listeners to go to drhoffman.com and download the podcast, unless you subscribe already via iTunes or Stitcher, however you listen, and listen to that one. Also, look at, if you don't already subscribe to the newsletter, of course, I went out with a newsletter last week, please check out drhoffman.com under podcasts and listen to, read the article that I wrote that is kind of a point-by-point rebuttal of the Frontline special. You didn't happen to see it, did you?
I did not. But I've heard enough about it, and I need to download and watch it. And be mortified like everybody else.
I know it was kind of a, you know, it's not fun.
I'm very disappointed in NPR. Yeah. I have to just say I'm just very, very disappointed because I was a huge fan of that station, but that's starting to change.
Yeah, and you know, I actually think that they may. You know, they rely to a large extent on private donations, and I think they're really going to piss off a lot of their constituency by, you know, it's one thing to question the supplement industry, and there's validity to that. You know, there's some bad stuff. There's some, like, male potency products that are spiked with actual Viagra or Levitra or whatnot. There's some
diet products, weight loss products,
ridiculous products that make extravagant claims. There are products that are they're poor quality, you know, rancid fish oil that, you know, you buy for $9.99 for a bottle of three, you know, or 500 or something. You know, and that's not the stuff that you'll find in the dispensary at drhoffman.com, because we're very careful about properly vetting the supplements. I mean, there's, you know, but compared to the toll that drugs cause, it is really minuscule. There are very few episodes of problems. They're relatively quickly corrected, and we don't need highly restrictive legislation to make it so that many supplement companies just give up the ghost, go out of business, and that consumers won't be able to get the supplements that they now rely on. I just think it's
unfortunately.
I'm fearful for what may happen in 2016. You know, and you know, just in the news, you know, I got to tell you, I, truth be told, I am not the biggest fan of Bernie Sanders in terms of many aspects of his political platform. But you know, look, I got to commend him for his idealism. He may not be that that practical in terms of things that he wants to implement for the country, but one of the things that he did was he really talked back to the administration and pushed back on the nomination of the latest FDA commissioner appointee, and said, don't put that guy in a position to regulate the supplement industry. He is a shill for the supplement industry. He's a guy with tremendous industry ties, and he is going to, you know, basically, you know, take, you know, put the fix on for many potentially hazardous drugs and accelerate their approval, because he's got too much skin in the game as a former as an insider, as a pharmaceutical, big pharma insider. So this is Bernie Sanders, and you know, no candidate would do this. No mainstream candidate would do this, because they rely on pharmaceutical contributions to the tune of millions, tens of millions of dollars.
He's almost not being political.
Yes.
With his stance.
How refreshing. How refreshing, you know.
And, how refreshing is right,
And you look, and you could argue that that Trump is a maverick, too, because the guy's a gazillionaire, and he doesn't need the money, you know, so he's self-funding his own campaign. Maybe Bloomberg, too. Bloomberg says he's ready to throw his hat into the ring. And, you know, so I'm just trying to be fair to all the candidates, all the political perspectives, because I got to say I have deep skepticism about many of the candidates who are now running, but I won't go into that. But you know, just from the perspective of our community of people interested in supplements and people who are really trying to push back against the excesses of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, Bernie Sanders looks like a champion of that cause. Anyway, so whatever.
Yeah, and 60% of the FDA are former pharmaceutical executives.
That's how it works.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's how it works. And then vice versa. Once you, I mean, look, it would be hypocritical to criticize that when we have the self-same situation with our Daniel Fabricant. But he answered my question by saying, look, I know the ins and outs of regulation. I was a regulator. I have a concern for the public as a regulator, and I have a concern for the public as someone who's head of the largest trade association of vitamin manufacturers. There's no contradiction there. And he was quite sincere about that. So I thought it was a good answer. Anyway, check it out. Tell us what you think when you listen to that podcast. All right, enough said. So let's get to questions, please.
Okay, we've got an email from Aaron. Aaron says, thanks for such a great program. You're my number one source for health and nutrition information. Is there a way to reverse plaque in the arteries? I know there are some things to help prevent plaque from forming, like vitamin K, maybe chiolic. Are there maybe some natural ways to stabilize plaque? However, if you already have plaque, is it reversible, and to what extent?
That's actually a good question. And
people
who, you know, I think one of the most robust ways to push back against plaque is to do chelation therapy. Chelation therapy has been shown to reduce the risk of subsequent heart attacks in especially diabetics, people who've already had heart attacks. So, but people who do chelation, sometimes they say, well, I had an EBT heart scan, a calcium scan. I want to see if the chelation worked. I had, you know, 30 or 40 or 60 chelations. I want to see how much of the plaque is gone. And I discourage them from doing that because my experience is that the plaque doesn't disappear. And at best, what you may see is a slowing in the growth of plaque. You know, we should only have bank accounts or investments like plaque in terms of the rate of growth, because on average, plaque increases 15 to 20% each year. That would be a great you know, bond fund or something, right? Or you know, but you know, nobody gets that kind of return
dividend
on investment.
Stocks, yeah,
exactly. But so what that means is that you can literally get a doubling of your plaque within a few years if you don't do anything about it. Some studies have shown that statins may somewhat slow that down. And I do believe that the chelation helps to slow that progression. But I think that the difference is that it may not make the plaque disappear on a test, but it may change the quality of the plaque, changing it from sticky plaque or ulcerated plaque, which is more likely to attract blood clots and cause a heart attack or a stroke, changing it to smooth plaque where the platelets don't stick. But I will share this with you.
Where it's more stable?
More stable, yeah. What's called stable plaque, yeah. So it's actually not just a numbers game. You know, it does. There's a rough correlation between the amount of plaque that you have and your risk of heart attack. Mm-hmm. So if you have a plaque score of 1,000, you're more likely to have a heart attack than if you have a plaque score of 100. On the other hand, you can see paradoxes. You can see people who have 1,000 and they're fine, and you can see people who have 100 who have a heart attack. So anyway, what I'm going to point out that this is interesting because I just got this, and I've already reported on the radio, but I want to reiterate it. New study shows aged garlic extract can reduce dangerous plaque buildup in arteries. So there's actually that can happen. And the guy who did the study I've interviewed on the show, Dr. Matthew Budoff, he's actually one of the world's experts on coronary calcium scoring and scanning. And he conducted trials using aged garlic extract. The study involved 55 patients aged 40 to 75 who had been diagnosed with metabolic syndrome. So we know they're already prone to cardiovascular disease, not diabetic, but metabolic syndrome. So they underwent screening at the beginning of the study for the total coronary plaque volume, as well as dense calcium, non-calcified plaque, and what's called attenuation plaque. So actually, these are more sophisticated research techniques where they don't just do total plaque. They can divide it into the dense plaque,
type of plaque.
Or non-calcified plaque, or you know, like sort of slicing and dicing, like okay plaque or worse plaque. And what they found was after they got the aged garlic extract for a year, follow-up screening conducted a year after this, after the initiation of the garlic, found that those who'd taken chiolic aged garlic extract had slowed plaque accumulation by 80%. Okay, so that means that they didn't get reversed, all right, but it slowed the plaque accumulation. So that was good. But here's the other thing. It reduced the soft plaque, they demonstrated some regression for what's called low attenuation plaque. So, you know, it depends on the type of plaque. There is actually the prospect that you can get some regression. And so that's just one of the tools that we have. We have things like resveratrol. We have fish oil, gamma-tocopherol-rich vitamin E. You can probably think of others that may
fish
have
fish oil, Vascuzyme.
Right. Curcumin may have a beneficial effect. So, you know, we would use sort of and of course, a dietary effect. I really believe that there's a dietary effect. You know, Dean Ornish, for all the controversy we have about vegetarian diet or like vegan diets versus low-carb diets, he's a dyed-in-the-wool vegan, you know, urges people to eat, you know, very low-fat diet. But he actually demonstrated regression of plaque with his program.
He did.
You know, and so kudos to him. It was a small study. It was, I think it was like a dozen people. But, and they did a lot of stuff. They didn't just, they exercised more. They had, they did meditation. They did like
they
a lot
meditation.
Of.
They did meditation. They had no stress.
Stress reduction.
But I remember that study because I was in grad school at the time, and we discussed it at length
right.
with my professor. And one of the conclusions that he came to is like, but it only showed the reversal of atherosclerosis in those with the most plaque.
Okay, right.
Not with somebody with a score of 100, as you said earlier,
right.
Dr. Hubb. It might be somebody with really, really bad. It showed some regression there, and that was about it. So I don't know.
So, you know, what that actually demonstrates is that in scientific studies, you have to sometimes look at the sickest people to see an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, I think,
yeah.
you see with statins, is that the sickest
yeah,
people benefit.
Yeah, because it worked for that population,
yeah.
even, you know, small study, but, hey, you have to take what works, you know.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
anyway. And vitamin K.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I think
yep.
there's even more burgeoning evidence. My feeling is that, you know, what we normally recommend as a dosage of vitamin K, is about 180 micrograms a day, you know, 290 microgram doses of MK7. And
right.
it's turning out that it may actually have to go higher than that.
Okay.
So I'm very interested to find out, to read more about, you know, how that's going to all unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a moving target right now.
Out of the arteries, yeah.
It's a moving target yeah. right now because we do currently recommend, I think, 180 micrograms per day of vitamin K2. But it's possible that we may, after more research is completed, discover that higher doses are beneficial. So, I think that's – I didn't want to leave the audience with the impression that they're making a mistake by taking 180. That's our present knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I take 180.
Okay, great.
Until I find out more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I bet, you know, yeah. I don't know, you probably haven't had your coronary plaque checked. You're a little young for that, especially as a woman.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I don't know, maybe, you know, and hit the big 6-0 or, you know, 6-5 or something like that. You'll check in and
yeah.
see if all this is paid off. I kind of, the way you eat and the way you exercise you're a slim body type, I just really don't think you're at high risk, but it's hard sometimes to know.
I hope not. I have such a strong family history.
Mm-hmm.
I have such a strong family history, especially on my mother's side of CAD, coronary artery disease, and type 2 diabetes, which I almost want to say are almost the same disease. That yeah, I really have to watch it.
Right. Well, you know, sometimes there's surprises when you do the test. Okay, so I think that pretty much fields the question for that person.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you for that question.
Sure.
Okay. We've got another email from Bo. Bo writes, about 5 years ago, and Bo is a man.
Okay.
About 5 years ago, I developed digestive issues with extreme bloating and anxiety attacks. I've had just about every test conceivable, alternative and conventional. One thing I've noticed is that I sweat very easily, almost like a sensitivity to heat, or if I walk half a block, my shirt is drenched. I'm athletic, and I'm in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Does the sweating clue you into anything? Oh, my.
Yeah, you know, look, this is...
Bloating and anxiety attacks.
Yeah, I think that those are related. I think that there's some dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system that is associated with, both the anxiety and the sweating, and may also be associated with the digestive abnormalities. So, you know, is this in the brain? Is this a mental disorder, or is this a physical problem? It's probably a little bit of both. The anxiety makes the physical problem worse. The physical problem makes the anxiety worse in a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when people say, I've had every test imaginable, there's always tests or potential answers that have not yet been uncovered. So I'm not going to comment on this because I don't know what's actually been done.
Yeah.
I would probably sit down with a patient like this and spend, 45 minutes or an hour reviewing everything. There is a possibility that there's something still amiss in the gastrointestinal tracts, like a form of dysbiosis. We know that there's a relationship between stress and your microbiome. Stress damages your microbiome, but conversely, microbiome abnormalities affect the brain and the nervous system and can produce anxiety and depression. So something's
the
going on
here. Gut-brain connection.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And that's worth investigating. So, you know, is there like a magic probiotic? Can we just say, oh, take Dr. Ahira's and you'll be fine? You know, take two Dr. Ahira's and call me in the morning. I'm not sure it's that simple. We don't know what this person's eating, what diet modifications they've undertaken. They may want to undertake, you know, an elimination diet or a paleo diet or something like that to see if the symptoms abate, because there are profound changes in brain and mood when you modify your diet. I just experienced this by undertaking the Whole 30 diet, which is a grain-free, legume-free diet, no alcohol, no sugar. And I really feel...
How's that going?
Good. I've re-upped. I'm now into my second round of it, because I kind of like it. And, you know, I was kind of tempted to get, you know, a bar of chocolate, you know, a jar of peanut butter, and a shot of vodka, you know, sit down and just have a big blowout. But I decided not to, you know. I mean, there's some things I haven't been able to have, or, you know, with maybe some nice raspberry jam on whole grain gluten-free bread. You know, but I did not reintroduce those things. And I just want to see over time if there's changes. You know, probably just sheer logistics during the summer where things get a little more hectic and I'm even more physically active. That may move me towards modifying it. But I like it. And I'm going to write an article for our listeners, a couple of articles, I think, on my review of the diet, both, you know, challenging a little bit some of the premises and taking a critical look at some of the ideas behind it, but also sharing with you some of my own personal impressions, what I experienced, and, you know, some of the foods that I found helpful to implement the diet. You know, I was in the street just this morning. I was on my way to the gym, and I saw, you know, one of the instructors at the gym, and he stopped me. He was all excited. He says, oh, he says, I read your article on the Whole 30 in your newsletter. And he says, I'm on the Whole 30. So we're having, you know, and he says, oh, I really feel good. So we're having a little bit of a viral effect. You know, whatever works to get people inspired to try a little bit of diet optimization, I think it's great. And, you know, many people in my family are doing it alongside me. It's kind of getting rid of those winter blahs. And actually, some of the folks that you know, Layla, the folks at MMG, who are responsible for putting up our website and for editing and producing our podcasts, they're you know, they read, you know, they have to edit my articles, you know, before I write the articles, but they, you know, if they see all the articles and, you know, they get it by osmosis. So they're saying, hey, you know, we're feeling kind of sluggish and lethargic. Why don't we just try that? So I'm anxious to see how it affects them.
Yeah. Oh, very exciting.
Yep.
Very exciting. Yeah. Okay. Well, Bo, best of luck to you. And we think you need a bigger workup.
Yeah, or maybe even just somebody, you know, and just one final thing on that is sometimes all the tests in the world, maybe he's had conceivably all the tests that are available. You need somebody to put those tests together for you. And that's what I do, and that's what you do in the office, is people bring sometimes reams and reams of previous tests, and they say, well, please make sense of this. Give me a direction. And that's what we try to do. Okay. All right. So let's pause, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts, as our listeners know, and give us a tease to part two. What are we going to discuss in the second part of today's Q&A with Layla?
Can I become allergic to the healthy foods I'm eating?
Okay. Worthy question. We'll take it up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today together with Hoffman Center Nutritionist Layla Mudin.